discussion wouldn't be why Marx was right. It would most emphatically be why Marx was wrong. How times have changed. Yes, times have changed quite a lot. And the change is taking place more and more swiftly. You know, 20 years ago, a very important event occurred. History ended. You know this? You don't? You remember it? You wouldn't. Most of you weren't around at the time. I was around. Yes, history ended. I remember it distinctly. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, which is supposed to represent the end of socialism, they proclaimed that, particularly this chap, Francis Fukuyama, one of the current philosophers of the bourgeoisie, that history had ended, if you please. Socialism had ended, communism had ended, history had ended. By the way, are there any history students here? Put your hand up. Any history? You can leave now, because history's ended, so put that in your next exam paper, see what happens. Yes, but you see, now, to be fair to Francis Fukuyama, because it seems a ridiculous assertion, history's ended. It seems absurd, it is absurd. But to be fair to Mr. Fukuyama, what he actually meant was not that history as such had ended. He didn't mean that at all. What he meant was that since, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, socialism and communism were alleged to be impossible, therefore, the capitalist system was the only possible system that could exist. Therefore, in that sense, history had ended. And that the only possible system for the future, forever and ever, amen, was the capitalist system, or as they prefer to call it now, the free market economy. Are there any students of economics in the room? Put your hand up. One admits to it. Anyone else prepared to confess? No, well, one at least. Very good. Well done. Now, you see, if you read the text, I dare say these textbooks are still being taught in universities. For the last 20 or 30 years, it was put as an item of gospel truth that the market, the free market, would solve all our problems. That there would never be another crisis. They stated this in black and white. There would never be, there could not be another crisis, like, for example, a repetition of 1929. Why? Well, because we learned from history. Now, my favorite philosopher of all times, the one that taught Marx, his philosophy was Hegel, who said a very profound thing in a wonderful book called The Philosophy of History. You might like to read it. He says the following: anyone who studies history can only draw one conclusion, that nobody has ever learned anything from history. Why? Because history constantly repeats itself. They steadfastly denied the possibility of a crisis of overproduction. I won't bore you with the economics. We can if you wish. I think it was called something of the perfect market hypothesis or nonsense to that effect. But in the year 2008, we had the biggest crisis of capitalism certainly for the last 60 years, but all of them admit that they can't very well deny it. But I would argue, and I'm not the only one that thinks this, we are now passing through the deepest and the most severe crisis in the history of capitalism for the last 200 years. By the way, don't believe anything I say. I happen to pick up today's copy of the Financial Times, which states, among other things, Britain's economy contracted even more sharply during the recession than previously believed. Yes, that's fair enough. And its recovery so far this year has been even more anemic, according to the official report as well. It's a very interesting article. I recommend you should read the FT. It's quite a good paper. But at the end it says the following. Moreover, wrong paragraph. Such a lot of good paragraphs in this, I got them mixed up. Several economists noted that in some respects, the current recession and the weak recovery are actually worse than in Britain in the 1930s. This is the Financial Times people, not analysts. Colin Ellis, chief economist at the British Venture Capital Association, noted that data from the National Institute for Economic and Social Research showed the peak-to-trough drop in output during the early 1930s was 7.6%, not far off the current 7.1% drop. Just imagine that. But it goes further. Moreover, it says, by this point, after the recession began in the 1930s, recovery was already well underway. One more weak quarter and the level of activity in the economy, the British economy, and the amount of time that has passed would make this recession even more severe than the one 80 years ago. This, my friends, is from the horse's mouth. Now, the most striking thing to me about this, and I could quote a lot more, I won't bore you with statistics. The most striking thing about this is it was not supposed to happen. This was steadfastly denied for the last 30, 40, or 50 years. I remember distinctly when I was at university. Oh, no, Marx was wrong. All this business about a crisis of capitalism, it's all nonsense, it's all. It's been belied by history. And yes, it did appear to be contradicted, to be falsified by the history since the Second World War. It was not, except for the 1973-74, there was a recession then. But in general, this was a period of full employment, of rising living standards, at least, of course, for the advanced capitalist countries. For the great majority of mankind living in the so-called third world, how I dislike that expression, but still, I can't think of a suitable alternative. For the great majority of the human race, this, even in this best period, the best that capitalism had to offer, it was a period of terrible suffering, poverty, misery, degradation, starvation. Yes, and even at the present time, even before the recession, by the way, before 2008, according to the figures of the United Nations, on a world scale, 1.2 billion people are living in dire poverty, that is to say, less than $2 a day. Okay? Of those 1.2 billion people, in the year of our Lord 2012, 8 million men, women, and children will die every year because they do not have enough resources to live, to maintain them, to keep them alive. It's hardly a brilliant advertisement, I would maintain, for the wonders of the free market economy. And again, I return to the same point. The bourgeois economists, all of them, the Keynesians, monetarists, I don't care, I've been completely incapable of explaining, analysing, or predicting anything for the whole of the last period. And in fairness, at least one prominent bourgeois economist called Paul Krugman, in July 2009, it was in London actually, a seminar of economists organised by the Economist Journal to discuss the crisis. What on earth is happening? Paul Krugman, this prominent Nobel Prize winner in economics, said the following, and I quote, he actually admitted, quote, that for the last 30 years, the developments in macroeconomic theory has been at best spectacularly useless, or at worst, directly harmful. This is Paul Krugman, one of the most prominent economists in the world. Therefore, the first observation I'll make is a negative one. You will seek in vain for any trace of an explanation or a serious analysis of what is happening in the world now in all the mountains of textbooks of bourgeois economics. It is worthless, it is rubbish, it is fit for the bin. And they know it. And they know it. Marx has suddenly come back into fashion in the most astonishing places you would never dream of. For example, there's a paper, I'm sure you all read this every day, called the L'Osservatorio Romano. Did I say that right, Fred? More or less. You know what that paper is, L'Osservatorio Romano? I know there's a couple of people that know. You know what this is? A well-known paper. It's the paper of the Vatican. The paper of the Vatican. Don't forget, Karl Marx said that religion was the opium of the people. Nevertheless, this is 2009 also, L'Osservatorio Romano published an article praising Karl Marx's diagnosis of income inequality. It's quite an endorsement of Marx, considering. In Germany, for the last couple of years, Das Kapital has been the bestseller. It's selling out. People are trying to understand what's happening. They have to resort to Marx because they won't find an explanation anywhere else. And it is true that the only serious explanation that you can find for what is occurring is precisely in the marvellously profound three volumes of Capital, which perhaps you can study. By the way, in Japan, you've got to take your hat off to the Japanese. They've published Das Kapital in a manga version. I think that's what they call it. You know what a manga version is? Do you? I didn't know till this afternoon. I had to ask. I've read this. A manga. What the hell is a manga version? It's one of these comic things. You know, how the hell you can publish Kapital in a manga version? Although in Shanghai, apparently, they're producing a musical based on Das Kapital. I mean, that's a bit more incredible. How on earth can you make Das Kapital? I suppose there's tastes for all kinds of things. They're looking to capital because there's no alternative. I'll just give one, not to bore you, but I'll just... Business Week, for example. Please, there must be places here. The comments can move over a little bit and let the masses in. Welcome. I was just saying that the bourgeois economists have absolutely no explanation for what is occurring, and therefore there's a growing interest in Marxism in general, Marxist economics in particular. Business Week published recently an article with the title Marx to Market. I got some quotes, but I haven't got time to deal with all these quotes. I'll give a couple of... Please come in. Okay, plenty of room.
Thank you very much.
The Business Week expressed astonishment. I mean, good heavens, after the collapse of Soviet Union, end of socialism, end of history, there are still people that take Marx seriously. Yes, my friends, you better believe it. Let me just give you a couple of names. This is from the Business Week article. George Magnus. Ever heard of him? Senior economist at UBS Bank. That's the major Swiss. That's one of the great temples of finance capital, the great Swiss bank. Published an article on the UBS website with the following title. Very interesting title. Give Karl Marx a chance to save the world economy, says George Magnus. I mean, this is staggering stuff. Astonishing stuff. And he points out another thing. He says, I quote, "The spirit of Marx, who is buried in a cemetery close to where I live in North London, has risen from the grave amid the financial crisis and subsequent economic slump." He goes on, and this is what he writes. The process he describes is visible throughout the developed world, particularly in the U.S. Companies' efforts to cut costs and avoid hiring have boosted U.S. corporate profits as a share of total economic output to the highest level in more than six decades. This is in the States. Oh, by the way, hold that quote in your head for a moment. The highest level of corporate profits in the States for 60 years, and yet at the present time, it was just published last week, these figures, that poverty in the United States, the richest country in the world, poverty in the United States has jumped to 15.1% of the population in 2010, which is 46.2 million Americans are now living in poverty. These are official figures, which understate the real thing. These are the highest figures for poverty for 52 years. So there you have it. The highest rate of profits and wealth for the last 60 years and the highest rate of poverty officially for the last 52 years. There are soup kitchens in America. There are tent cities in America. And you see the result. If you just put your television set on, you see the result. You have this very interesting phenomenon of a demonstration in Wall Street, or at least it's not quite in Wall Street, because the American democracy is such that they wouldn't allow them to enter Wall Street. They put a barricade up, manned by the police, and they gassed the people, turned on them, arrested hundreds of them. It started off as a movement of the students. That shouldn't surprise us, by the way. You see, it's true that the students, we mustn't get carried away, it's true that the students can play a really independent role in the class struggle. However, in all countries, at all times, students and intelligentsia, if you like, has always been a sensitive barometer which accurately reflects the pressures, the tensions, the discontent, the subterranean contradictions, if you like, which beneath the surface are building up. And therefore they can move before the working class moves. Now that's what's occurring in the States. And of course, a lot of these kids turn up. They don't obviously don't have much clue. They're new to politics. They turn up dressed as clowns, dressed as zombies, and so on. I think that was directed at the people who work in Wall Street. Yes, but immediately it was joined by the workers, by the thousands of workers, trade unionists, auto workers, teachers, all kinds of people turned up because they said, look, these kids are expressing what we feel because we are under attack. Our living standards are falling and these fat cats are living off our back and it's got to stop. There were people, there are people, as I speak, on the streets of New York, I'm not talking about the streets of Cairo or Tunisia or Caracas or Petrograd in 1970, I'm talking about New York now. Middle class people, or people that used to consider themselves as middle class to be more accurate, that are talking in revolutionary terms. There was a woman that was interviewed last night, I don't know if you saw that, I think it was on Newsnight, or Channel 4 News, I think it was. The journalist interviewed this woman, and she was obviously a middle-aged woman, hardly what you'd consider to be a raving anarchist or a Bolshevik agitator. Respectable middle class lady, maybe a teacher or something, maybe a retired, I don't know. Middle class, obviously, as well. She said the following. We need another American Revolution. That's what the woman said. I think that the reporter's jaw dropped. But you see, the fact of the matter is this. 20 years after what was supposed to be at the end of history, the wheel of history has turned 180 degrees. And things, as Marx explained, as dialectics explain, Marxist philosophy explains, sooner or later everything turns into its opposite, and that's what's occurring. Hence, the interest which is being shown. Now, I must quote a little bit more from this chap, Magnus, George, what's his name? George Magnus, that's right. He says, US income equality, meanwhile, is by some measures close to its higher level since the 1920s. George Magnus is right, chief economist of the UBS. These guys are worried. They are seriously worried, and they're right to be worried. Before 2008, I'm quoting all the time from this Magnus, though. Before 2008, the income disparity was obscured by factors such as easy credit, which allowed poor households to enjoy a more affluent lifestyle. Now the problem is coming home to roost. Yes, and it is an indissoluble problem. It's an indissoluble problem. It really is quite amusing that the Americans are lecturing the Europeans. You know, there's a seat here, but okay. I won't bite you, I promise. Oh, there we are. He thinks I'm going to bite him, obviously. Marx is not really like that, you know. It's all lies. But you see, the Americans are lecturing the Europeans. You must do something. You must solve Greece. You must do something. What the hell? What the Europeans reply? What the hell are we supposed to do? You tell us. Oh, by the way, you're lecturing us. What about your deficit? Which is immense. Which they can't resolve. And they're split down the middle. The Republicans and Democrats are split down the middle. Which explains this enormous ferment, which you see everywhere. Now, you see, if we could just return a moment to the general world situation. Incidentally, let's return to the title of the speech, in case you thought I forgot. It isn't just that Marx was right. Why was Marx right? Now, you know, the most modern book which you can read was written over 150 years ago by two young fellas. They were very young. Written in 1848. I'm referring to the Communist Manifesto. Hands up, all of you that have read the Communist Manifesto. Put your hands up. Not bad. Okay. Right. So read it again. Read it again. Those of you who have not read the Communist Manifesto, I appeal to you, please read it. Let's make a little challenge. I mean, I assume that in this wonderful temple of learning, that there must be a library. Am I correct, or have they abolished that as well? Is there a library? You don't know? Fine students. Fine students that don't know there's a library. Is there a library?
No.
Yes. No? Well, there must be. Okay, not in this building. There must be a library somewhere. There's a very good one around the corner. It's called the British. Oh, it's not there anymore. They've moved it. Anyway, it's in St. Pancras. Terrible place. Go to the British Museum, if I go to the British Library, ask for any bourgeois book written 150 years ago about economics, politics, sociology, and I will tell you in advance, you can read that book, I'll tell you in advance, that book will merely have an historical interest. Application to the relevance to the present world, zero. I guarantee it. Okay? Now you take the Communist Manifesto written in 1848 and read it, if you know, several of you, but half the people here said you've not read it. You must read this. Even if you're not a Marxist, not a communist, not even leftist, you should read it as a part of a great part of world literature. I mean, this is one of the books that changed human history, so therefore there's no excuse for not reading it. But when you do read it, I'll tell you what, you'll have a surprise. If you haven't read this book, you'll have a surprise. Because here is a book written in 1848, over 150 years ago, which perfectly describes the world, yes, but not the world of 1848, not at all. Not at all. It describes the world now. And it describes it in astonishing detail. And more importantly, it explains what is occurring. Never mind about capital, you'll find an explanation written in very simple language, because Marx and Engels wrote for ordinary people, wrote for workers. Anyone can understand that. Don't be frightened of that. Anyone can read the Communist Manifesto. Capitalism may be a bit more difficult. But here's an astonishing fact. 150 years ago, let me give you two examples. Marx made predictions. Of course, if Marxism is a science, and we say that it is a science, scientists should be able to make verifiable predictions. They should be able to check the results. Marx made several predictions. One of the main predictions he made was something called globalization. Okay? Most people think globalization is a new idea. It's one of the buzzwords. It's a new idea. It's a new, entirely original idea. It was only invented, 20 or 30 years ago? Not so. False. Marx and Engels predicted globalization in the Communist Manifesto and explained the reason for it. They explained how capitalism evolves historically out of feudalism, how it develops, and they explained how capitalism always starts as a national economy, but that the national limits are too narrow for the development of the productive forces, and therefore, instead of nation states, you get a world market. World market, world politics, world culture, world literature. Marx explains this very clearly in the manifesto. Yes, but when he wrote these things, this did not exist. Nothing remotely resembling what they wrote existed in 1848. There was only one capitalist country at that time. Only one developed country of capitalism, that was this one. Britain or England, to be more precise. France was beginning to develop, Germany was still in its infancy. And there was no question of a world market or anything like this. And yet, now, 2012, the most, what did I say? I'm thinking of the Olympic Games, I'm thinking how to avoid them, actually. I live just around the corner. What a getaway. 2011, I beg your pardon. You see, I'm in advance of history here. 2011, over 150 years later, one of the most important facts of our epoch is precisely this: the crushing domination of the world market, so-called globalism. No country can escape from this. Soviet Union couldn't escape from it, although it was a subcontinent. China couldn't escape from it. Britain, France, and so they can't escape them. Yes, but now they're trapped. Now they're trapped. Because globalization, which undoubtedly benefited them in the last period, has now precisely turned into its opposite. And the crisis of globalization manifests itself as a global crisis of capitalism. That's why they're terrified about Greece. Just think for a moment, doesn't it? It doesn't seem to make sense. How on earth can Obama be alarmed at what is occurring in a little peripheral country in the southeast of Europe? How can Greece, which is a tiny country, why are they all terrified? Why are they terrified about Greece? Well, it's a simple answer to that, and it's to do with globalization. The FT put it like this. He said, look, it's like a group of mountaineers. They are tied together by a rope, and it doesn't matter if there's a big guy at the bottom and a little guy is at the top. If the little guy falls, they're all going to fall. It's all very well for the Germans to blow hot and blow cold, make the Greeks suffer, make the Greeks pay. Pay with what? the Greeks couldn't be excused for that. They've squeezed the Greek people until they're white. You can't squeeze blood from a stone. Greece cannot pay. Greece will not pay because it cannot pay. And the more austerity they pile on the Greek people, the more they're pushing Greece over the precipice. That's how capitalism operates. And now they're complaining like, oh no, we can't send any more money to Greece. And the answer is, the serious economist is, oh, can't you? Oh, can't you? Well, just try it. If Greece goes, you know what? The very next day the French banks are going to go, because Greece is heavily indebted to French banks. And the German banks are going to go. It will drag the lot down. That's why they're so bad. And of course, if that occurs, the euro will go. So if you've got a few million euros in your account, I would get rid of them a bit sharper. So although what to put in, gold is a good bet, maybe, or works of art. I wouldn't bother with the dollar very much, because that will be next. And that's the point. Obama says, he picks up the phone and he says to the Europeans, you guys better sort out Greece, because America's economic recovery depends on a solution to the Greek problem. He said this a couple of months ago. That's the seriousness of it. And what it means is they're all tied together by this phenomenon of globalization, which Marx and Engels predicted in the pages of the Communist Manifesto. Prediction number one. Prediction number two, which also did not have the slightest basis in fact when Marx and Engels wrote the manifesto. That is to say, he explained the process of the concentration of capital. That's to say, that capitalism inevitably produced a process of the, on the one hand, enormous concentration of wealth in a few hands, wealth and power and economic power in a few hands, and on the other hand, an enormous concentration of poverty, suffering, unemployment, hunger, starvation, and so on. This is precisely what is occurring in the world at the present time. You know, when I was in university, sorry to be a bore, it seems like yesterday, you know, how time passes when you're enjoying yourself. You know, they used to say, oh, no, Marx was wrong, because there's no concentration of capital, there's no polarization, we're all middle class, you remember that one? There's no working class in capital, it's all middle class. Oh, yes, uh-huh. I've just given the figures in relation to that. Oh, yes, and small is beautiful. You heard that one? Small is beautiful? You haven't heard of it? Well, they haven't used it lately, but they repeated it. Now, my wife is sitting there. She's small, and she's very beautiful. But, of course, there's nothing to do with it. It's nothing to do with it. We're not talking about aesthetics here. We're talking about economics. What they meant to say is the future is not with big monopolies. It's with tiny little micro-biz. You know, a chap shows initiative, sets up a computer thing in his back garage, and he becomes a millionaire. You just try it. It is absolute arrant nonsense. Absolute arrant nonsense. It's a lie. On the contrary, the economy of the United States, of Britain, and of the entire world has never been so monopolized than what it is at the present time. At this moment that I'm speaking, the entire world economy, and that's saying something, is in the hands of no more than 200... What does that say? Oh. That's in Swedish. I can't read that. Oh, I see. There we are. That's better. Tack så mycket. The entire economy, world economy, is in the hands of not more than 200 gigantic companies. Most of them are in America, not all of them. Some of them are in Japan, some of them are in China. Oh, by the way, who's the richest man in the world? You know? Anyone know?
In Mexico.
Clever man. Carlos Slim, a Mexican, a poor country. Yes, and this gangster is the richest man in the world. Colossal concentration of capital, as Marx explained. And yet when Marx wrote that prediction, it didn't seem to be the case. There were no big businesses in Britain or in France or in Germany. None. They were all small businesses at that time, competing against each other. But Marx explained that it's the logic, it's the dialectic, if you like, of free competition, is precisely to create monopolies. Competition eradicates itself, it defeats itself. You drive people out, competitors out of business, and you concentrate wealth into a few hands, which is precisely the position we're living at the present time. What decides our destinies What does, and this is a fact I'd like you to consider, just to think about this. What decides the destinies of hundreds of millions of people, of billions of people, whether you will get a job or not, whether you will work or whether you will not work, whether you will earn money or not, whether you will have a house or not, whether you will have an education or not, is determined by the blind, anarchic play of market forces. It's determined by the activities of the stock exchange, which is like a colossal casino. That is what determines everything. Now, there was an... Oh, by the way, I must recommend this. It's on our website, Marxist.com, which I invite you all to read. But you'll probably find it on YouTube. A fascinating interview by a market trader, a so-called independent market trader, whose name is Alessio Rastani. I don't know what nationality the chap is. Alessio is Italian, but Rastani is something else. He's a market trader. These are one of the guys that decide what occurs to Greece and what occurs to Germany. And he says the following. Well, he says the following. He says, no matter what the governments do, he says, no matter what they do, there is going to be another recession. They all agree on this. I've got some wonderful quotes, which I can come back to in a moment. There is going to be another recession. By the way, forget about it. It's not a double dip. This is nonsense. What do you mean, double dip? That implies that there's been a recovery. There's been no recovery since 2008. Where's the recovery? So there's no double dip. But there's going to be another deeper recession. And they cannot do anything to stop it. They cannot do anything to stop it. Although, I hasten to add, that yes, there are some mechanisms whereby the capitalists could avoid the recession. Yes, indeed. The trouble is they've used them all up over the last 30 years. Avoiding a recession, for example, by keeping interest rates low, which is responsible for this speculative boom in housing and so on in the United States and so on. The Federal Reserve kept interest rates artificially low. We shouldn't have done so. That's the reason for the present financial mess. Now they're in a crisis, now they're in a mess, and of course one of the levers which they ought to use is reduce interest rates. Now how on earth can you reduce interest rates when they're close to zero? Unless, of course, you're going to say that the banks are going to pay me to borrow money off them. I don't think the banks quite work like that. You can't use that mechanism. What's the other mechanism? And they're all appealing, oh yeah, the state must spend money. Isn't that comic? Just get a load of this, my friends. Why was Marx right? Well, let me just look at this. Look at the logic of it, or rather the complete absence of any logic. For decades, they've all been singing the same song, the same tedious, repetitious melody. Market, market, market. You know? To market, to buy a fat pig. Home again, jiggity jig. You know, the market, the free market will solve all our problems, they said repeatedly. Okay? And what must the government do? The government must keep out. That's what the government must do. Laissez-faire, laissez-aller. It's not a new theory, it's a very old theory. The state must not intervene in anything. The market will solve. Yes, but what happened in 2008, my friends? What occurred when the market collapsed? When the whole banking system of the whole world collapsed because of the absolutely astounding irresponsible speculation, unprecedented speculation. What occurred? They immediately, the bankers go rushing to the government with a cap in their hand, not asking for money, demanding money. They demand money with menaces. Give us money. And they give the money. George W. Bush, really comical, the cheek of these Republicans is astonishing. The Tea Party people, it's astonishing. They complain about Obama and so on. It was George Bush that was responsible for giving trillions of dollars to the banks. This Republican, the principle of a solid dollar and a sound budget and balanced budgets and all the rest of the nonsense, straight through the window. They went running to the bankers with an open checkbook. The bankers just said, thank you very much. Still do not invest. Still do not rather lend money to people to invest. And pocket huge bonuses into the process. That's why you've got demonstrations on Wall Street. I think many people who are not Marxist, not socialist, not left-wing, are at least beginning to think, now hang on a sec, what's going on here? Whoa, we've got a deficit, says Mr. Cameron and his Lib Dem echo. Oh, we've got a deficit. We've got to solve the deficit. Therefore, look, I'm sorry, girls and boys, no money for grants, no money for universities, students must pay, no money for hospitals, close hospitals, no beds for sick people, no pensions for old people, work till you don't. And then they turn on and they wonder why there's youth unemployment. And they say, no, you've got to work until you drop. That's what the argument is. Cut, 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 cut. Got to cut, got to solve the deficit. Nobody ever asked the question, including, I'm sorry to say, Ed Miliband. Nobody asked the question, yes, why have we got a deficit? Where did all this money go? And the answer is, of course, don't tell anybody, will you? It went to the banks. So all that has happened between 2008 and now is that they have transformed what was a colossal black hole in the banking system into a colossal black hole of the public finances. Yes, and who pays for this? I ask. You know the answer to that question? Not the bankers. Who pays?
We think.
Not the, who do I think? Yeah, we know the answer. The poor, the sick, the old, the students, the unemployed, the homeless, the poorest and most vulnerable sections, the working class and the middle class. You must pay for this mess. Now, I ask you a question. The argument was about the alleged superiority of the market economy. Oh, well, we take risks. We take risks. We're entitled to earn big profits because we take risks. Where's the risk? Can anyone see a risk here? I can't see any risk. And the fact of the matter is, get your heads around this. If you forget everything else I've said, remember this. At this moment in time, every single one of the big private banks in the world only exists, and a large part of big industry also, like the American car industry, only exists thanks to state aid. And they talk about poor individuals that allegedly make money on benefits sheets and so on. Good God, the biggest benefits sheets around it are precisely the big banks. Now ask yourself the following question. Where is the superiority, the alleged superiority of the free market system? Where is it? You can tell me, and I'll ask you the question, please answer. If anyone can find the superiority, I don't know. The capitalist system has failed. It has failed catastrophically. It's failed everybody. It's continuing to fail, and it will continue to fail because they do not have any solution to this problem. With your permission, you are entitled to a little bit of harmless amusement, you know. Oh yes, crisis of overproduction, which is supposed not to take place. And here, this Magnus gives the figure. The problem, too, is evident in today's developed world. We have a substantial capacity, listen to this, we have a substantial capacity to produce. We have a substantial capacity to produce, I would add, everything. Food, clothes, shelter, schools, hospitals, universities. We have a substantial capacity to produce. But in the middle and lower income cohorts, we find widespread financial insecurity and low consumption rates. The result is visible in the US, where new housing construction and automobile sales remain about 75% and 30% below their 2000 peaks, respectively. This is what is known as a crisis of overproduction. And the chap quotes, as Karl Marx put it in Capital, quote, the ultimate reason for all real crises always remains the poverty and restricted consumption of the masses. That's Marx. That is called a crisis of overproduction. And that's precisely what you've got at the present time. There are many other quotes. Oh, yes, John Gray recently wrote for the BBC magazine on the 4th of September, a couple of weeks ago, an article entitled A Point of View, The Revolution of Capitalism. In which, again, he points out that Marx was right. Let me quote the description of this bourgeois of Britain at the present. He writes this. The old argument was, we can all advance. All you've got to do is to work hard and save money and you can be rich and you can be a millionaire and so on. And we can be middle class and everyone's middle class and the rest of it. That was the argument. Okay? This has been falsified by events. It's been falsified by history, as the Americans have just realized. I quote from John Gray on the BBC's website. In fact, in Britain and the US, and many other developed countries over the past 20 or 30 years, the opposite has been happening. Job security doesn't exist. The trades and professions of the past have largely gone, and lifelong careers are barely memories. If people have any wealth, it's in their houses, but house prices don't always increase. When credit is tight as it is now, they can be stagnant for years. A dwindling minority can count on a pension, on which they could comfortably live, and not many have significant savings. This man is not a Marxist, quite the opposite. More and more people live from day to day with little idea what the future may bring. Middle-class people used to think that their lives unfolded in an orderly progression, but it's no longer possible to look at life as a succession of stages in which each is a step up from the last. In the process of creative destruction, that was Schumpeter's graphic description of how capitalism works, in the process of creative destruction, the ladder has been kicked away, and for increasingly numbers of people, a middle-class existence is no longer even an aspiration. Now, these are facts, crude facts about the reality of the present world in which we live. And these words, by the way, are a devastating condemnation of the capitalist system. Now, there were many other quotes here which I would love to give, but I think I've almost made the point that I was after. Of course, all these gentlemen, yes, in their desperation to find some kind of an explanation, some kind of logic to this ghastly situation, yes, they rummage through the pages of Capital and they say, oh my goodness, yes, Marx was right on this and Marx was right on that. But, they all agree on this, but Marx was wrong about socialism. Socialism ain't the answer. They don't know what the answer is. None of them got the faintest idea what the answer is. But it's not socialism. Now, I would beg to differ. First of all, let us be clear on one thing. What failed 20-odd years ago in the Soviet Union was not socialism in any sense that would have been understood by Marx or Lenin or by myself. What failed in any event was a bureaucratic and totalitarian caricature of socialism. That certainly failed. And it had to fail. And it did fail. Yes, but socialism, all that socialism means is that the majority of society must own and control the means of production, which must be run democratically, must be run with the democratic participation of all the people. Now, what's wrong with that? What's wrong with that? Are we seriously saying, are we seriously maintaining that this goddamn mess, this anarchy, this vile system, the words fail me, is the best that the human race can come up with? Are we seriously? I consider that to be a calumny on the human race. I consider that to be an insult to the intelligence of humanity. Oh, no. I'll tell you also, in relation to Russia, it's a separate discussion which we can have. The Russian Revolution did prove something. When they now say, oh, no, it didn't succeed, nothing was ever achieved, that's wrong. That's wrong. That's simply not true. What the Soviet Union did demonstrate, beyond a shadow of doubt, for a number of years, is the following, that it is possible to run the economy of a vast subcontinent without private capitalists, without landlords, and without bankers, and to get, yes, excellent results. Because they did get excellent results. Now they try to conceal the fact. Of course, Russia was a very poor, backward, underdeveloped country, and that set its stamp on the development of the revolution. This is a separate discussion which we can have. But that's not the case in the United States at the present time. That's not the case in Britain. That's not the case in Italy. These are developed, advanced societies with an educated population which cannot be put to work by capitalism. And all I'm saying is this. What is required is a democratic plan of production in America, in Britain, in Europe, which is capable of mobilizing this, what he says himself, this vast, almost unlimited productive capacity which exists. I mean, there's no reason on earth why we should not produce houses, schools, hospitals, universities, no reason at all. We have the land, we have the bricks, we have the cement, we have unemployed building workers, we've got unemployed teachers. Why? What is preventing all these factors of production, to use their expression, from coming together to build houses, schools, and hospitals? Only one thing. And that is private ownership of the means of production, which is a barbarous state of affairs. By what right does a handful of individuals decide what is produced and what is not produced purely on the grounds of private profit? Comrades and friends, it does not make any sense whatsoever. What sense is it to hand out trillions to the bankers and just leave these gentlemen to carry on their own sweet way, doing the same things that they did? Oh, no. The banks should be expropriated. By the way, not a penny of compensation. Not a cent. They've had plenty. The banks should be expropriated, along with the big industries, the big firms, the big supermarkets. Not interested in the small shops, leave them alone. The small pubs, the small garages, leave them alone. Leave them in private hands. It doesn't make any difference. Because once we control these things, what somebody once referred to as the commanding heights of the economy, we'd be in a position to plan the economy, to decide what is produced democratically, on the basis, not bureaucratically, democratically, with the full participation of the entire population, in order for this marvellous productive capacity to be mobilised for what? Not for private profit, but for the satisfaction of human needs. That is the meaning of socialism, of genuine socialism. That is the message of Karl Marx, and that, comrades and friends, is why, yes, Marx was right.